Ladies and gentlemen, or maybe I should say for this occasion, comrades, thank you very much for coming to this very packed meeting of the FCC. We are very fortunate to have Christine Lowe with us, but just before we get on to the substance of today's event, let me quickly tell you that March is a very busy month for the FCC. I don't want to go over all the events we've got, but we have got two events that have just been announced today. On the 23rd of this month, we've got Ambassador David Mulford talking about global financial crisis in the emerging world. And on the 29th, we've got Bill Fisher talking about China's obsessive love affair with English. you can work that out yourselves. The subject of today's event is the enormous elephant in the room, the biggest political party in Hong Kong, the largest and most influential political party in Hong Kong, yet apparently it doesn't exist. I remember when I first came to Hong Kong, I asked several people, can you give me a good book to read about the Communist Party in Hong Kong? And I was absolutely staggered to discover that there was no such thing. Well, now we have such a thing. Rather typically, it comes from Christine Lowe, because she's the sort of person who, if you want to get something done in Hong Kong, you ask Christine to do it. So on this occasion, she's come up trump. I haven't got all the way through the book. This is I commend it to you wholeheartedly. It's an extremely interesting book. And Christine Lowe, you may say, is an unusual person to write a book like this. She's the CEO of Civic Exchange. She's been a legislator. And in fact, when she was a legislator, there was a famous event when she dared to ask the question in LegCo about the Communist Party. And as she says in the book, you've never seen the government benches empty so quickly, as they all excluded themselves from the room, so nobody needed to be there to answer the question. She's also, as I say, been a member of LegCo. There's a sort of list of things that she does. And it's very easy to say nice things about Christine Lowe, so I went the extra mile to try and think of something derogatory to say. And I've come up with two derogatory-ish things. She is a lawyer by training, but she's mitigated that by not practising the law. And she has been a commodities trader. I'm not sure that's sinister, but we could pretend that it was. So if you'll ignore those two minor faults, please welcome Christine Lowe.
Well, thank you very much for coming. And thank you to those of you in the room who have indirectly or directly helped me on this particular book, including my family, who had to tolerate me for spending hours and hours and days and months sitting alone in my room, refusing to be gregarious about anything. But let me start by saying what this book is not. This book is not a critique of the Chinese Communist Party. It is also not one of those books that you're going to find a list of the secret party members in Hong Kong. So if you're looking for that kind of book, you're going to be disappointed. However, this is a short story of the Chinese Communist Party in Hong Kong. It is a short story because I think there's a much longer story that we can be telling, but we do need to do more research. We need more people to be interested in this very compelling story. So the story starts in 1921, when the party was established in China, and it ends for this book last year in 2009. Now, the party is just under 100 years old. This is a lifetime of about three generations. And I think almost every Hong Kong family have been touched by this period of history. This is a part of the important history of modern China. If I were allowed just one word to describe the book, I would choose the word contradiction. While it was a historical shame for China to have lost Hong Kong to Britain in the 19th century, under a series of unequal treaties, a colonial territory at the southern tip of China proved to be extremely convenient. It was extremely convenient for the Chinese Communist Party. So from the time of the birth of the party, Hong Kong served as a useful, secure haven for party members and friends of the party to continue with revolution and political activities in Hong Kong. These included using Hong Kong as a communications and propaganda center, a fundraising facility, an intelligence gathering post, and of course, to also receive gifts from compatriots to trade, to invest, and to raise loans. Hong Kong's enormous usefulness to the party is exactly why the party has tolerated Hong Kong for so long. Indeed, the one country, two systems principle devised in the 1980s sought to preserve that contradiction. The party wanted the best of both worlds, to have reunification under special arrangements that maintain Hong Kong and its lifestyle and to retain its prosperity, but under a different system. I want to say something about the status of the party, because the contradiction affects that status even to today, when Hong Kong is, of course, already a part of the People's Republic of China. A central question that runs through the core of this book is why the mighty Chinese Communist Party is an underground organization here. Why is it so coy in Hong Kong? The wider colonial background has something to do with this. After World War II, the British introduced a system of registrations of persons and of organizations and political groups in various parts of the colonial empire. The idea was to block access for China to reach into the overseas Chinese community as a way to halt the spread of communist ideas to the population at large. Obviously, the Chinese Communist Party was not about to register in Hong Kong. Moreover, why should it register in Hong Kong when the party claims sovereignty over Hong Kong in any case? Now, the British, interestingly, wasn't about to make a fuss about this because they really couldn't. There were many people who were openly declaring their allegiance to the People's Republic of China. Just think about the leftist schools, the leftist unions, and left organizations, commercial organizations throughout Hong Kong. It would have been just too much for the British to suppress. Therefore, it was much easier just not to say very much about it. And what about the Hong Kong community? Well, the Hong Kong community wanted to look forward and not backward. Just think of the tens of thousands of people whose families were split between the communists and the nationalists, who then found their way to Hong Kong. Hong Kong was their new refuge. They were living with each other, cheek by jowl, in tenements. They were also co-workers trying to make a living. It was just better not to talk about it. And I wonder how many families in Hong Kong, including mine, who had people on both sides of the political fence. It was better just not to address the issue at all. So there was a sense of political tolerance that had to be created in Hong Kong. This habit of not really addressing those issues has become a habit of silence, and it's still very much with us today. But nowhere else in the world is there a system where the ruling party remains an underground organization as it does here. So, is it time for the party to come out? Let me come back to this question later. If you permit me a second word to describe this book, I would use the word contest. The contest has been over the identity of the people of this city. There was an inherent contradiction in Beijing's policy towards sovereignty. While there was de facto British rule in Hong Kong, the party felt the need to periodically remind the people of Hong Kong that Hong Kong was under temporary British occupation, and they must not forget the historical humiliation of the situation. At various points in time, the contradiction and the contest boiled over, and we all remember what happened for 6 months in 1967. At the end of that campaign, Zhou Enlai and other pragmatists in Beijing managed to stop what was economically an extremely expensive upheaval. But the party organization after 1967 was essentially destroyed. And also at the same time, the sympathy from Hong Kong people for the communist cause was lost. So when the party made up its mind in 1981 to take Hong Kong back in 1967, a key united front strategy was to win over the hearts and minds of the people of this city. The Cultural Revolution should be forgotten. The political and economic elites in Hong Kong had to be persuaded that their long-term interest rests with China. The party in Hong Kong used to reside within San Wa Se, the Xinhua News Agency. Its real name was the Hong Kong and Macau Work Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. Under its then director, who was also the head of the party, Xu Jiatuan, what they sought to do was to cultivate the elites in Hong Kong so that they would feel comfortable enough to transfer their loyalty from the British to Beijing. Xu Jiatuan observed in his memoirs that in dealing with the capitalist economic elites, that is, the business VIP in town, their political inclinations usually followed their commercial interest and could be influenced by offering the right kind of rewards. Not only were the local VIPs wined and dined, but they were invited to Beijing and given a chance to meet top Chinese leaders who explained to them about the regime's values and also managed to persuade them very effectively that they would continue capitalism in Hong Kong. It was an intoxicating experience for many of these VIPs who were invited to Beijing, as you can imagine. Sitting close to the seat of power, it's truly fascinating. It was something that they didn't get that often to do with the British. June 4th in 1989 presented a setback, but it was overcome through the intensification of United Front work and hard bargaining with the British. The bargain, as you will remember, was to allow a few more seats to be directly elected to LegCo. In time, an election machinery would need to be constructed by the party to ensure friendly forces won elections. An important part of the story is how the party fashioned a new political order to take power and to maintain power in 1997 and thereafter. The first glimpse of the individuals that the party cultivated was the 101 people who were invited to Beijing in 1984 to witness the signing of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. The most illustrious of them were subsequently invited to serve on the Basic Law Drafting Committee. A larger group was invited to join the Basic Law Consultative Committee. During the final years of British rule, an even larger group of people were made Hong Kong Affairs Advisors and District Affairs Advisors. I think many of you can remember that. And in the very final stages of British rule, Beijing created the Preliminary Working Committee, the Selection Committee, the Preparatory Committee, and of course, the selection committee ultimately selected our first chief executive. All of these people were essentially drawn from the same pool. These were what I would call, or what has been called, status markers. So who were these new power holders? They were the same types of people who were appointed by the British, quite apart from the psychological comfort for us all to see essentially the same faces. It was also critical for Beijing to keep their promises to the VIPs, that indeed, in the smooth transfer of sovereignty, they would be influencing, they would be playing a role in Hong Kong's politics. And as the process has expanded since, not only are we seeing some of those people continuing to serve on these various committees in Hong Kong, we're also seeing their children now populating Hong Kong committees, sitting on national and regional people's political consultative conferences, as well as local and national people's congresses. There's actually a series of appendixes in the book where I try to track who were appointed and how they were continuously appointed through a number of these bodies. So in conclusion, I'd like to just make two final points. The first one is, of course, to persuade you to buy a copy of the book before you leave today. Apart from what I've said, there are, I think, truly riveting bits of history that we may not have remembered. First of all, during the 1920s in Hong Kong, it was Hong Kong that inspired the communists on the mainland with the boycotts and the strikes in the 1920s. Secondly, is we have a wonderful period of time during the war years where the East River guerrillas fought in Hong Kong and in Guangdong. I think it's one of those still under-researched, fascinating part of history that we can all do more work towards. Then, of course, there is the gut-wrenching and bloody challenge between the communist and the nationalist. That story, the one in Hong Kong, the one that took place in Hong Kong, I think it's, again, a fascinating story that has not been fully told. And it's little known that at one point, the Guangdong Party Center was actually in Hong Kong and how active it was. So I think if you're interested in any of those bits of the history as well, I hope that will compel you to buy a copy of the book. Now, lastly, I promise to come back to one issue. Is the party ready to come out? Well, actually, I don't think it is. To operate in the open, for the party member list to be open, for the underground apparatus to be open, I think it would lead to many questions. And I'm not sure the party is ready for that. But I'm also not sure the people of Hong Kong is ready for it. In 2007, I was very grateful to Dr. Michael DeGolia of the Hong Kong Transition Projects for being willing to add a few extra questions in one of his regular people survey that you know very well, to ask the people how they feel about the party. That part of the survey has never been published, so I think for the media sitting there, it is news. The survey questions and analysis is at the back of the book. But as a summary, this is what I'd like to share with you. So one of the questions that we asked was whether party members should be declared. Nearly 50% of the respondents said no. They thought things should just continue as they are. Thank you.
Christine, thank you very much indeed. We'll follow the usual convention. If you just indicate, if you have a question, say who you are. I can't see, but apparently there's somebody over there, so behind a wall.
Hi. Well, Dazan McLean from National Geographic. I'm curious as to what your opinion is. Relationship between AB and the Chinese Communist Party. Are they the proxies for the Communist Party in Hong Kong, or is the relationship between the DAB and the CP a little more subtle than that in the way it plays out in Hong Kong politics?
I think the question is, are they a proxy for the Communist Party? I think the history of the DAB and a number of other political organizations are quite well documented. Through the media. The DAB, I don't think I'm in a position to say whether they are the Communist Party, but however, I think the DAB is, it's not a secret that they're very close to China, they're very close to Beijing. We see the close connection all the time, and they are the biggest party in Hong Kong today. They now have over 10,000 members. They are probably the best resource party in Hong Kong. In my book, I quote something that has already been in the media, a response to a media question just very recently from Zhang Yuxing, who is now the president of LegCo. He gets asked all the time whether he's a party member or not. And I believe this is the most recent times when he became the president of LegCo. He was asked again whether he was a party member, and his response is fascinating. He said, "I'm disappointed at you for asking this question."
Mark Pinkston. Wait, just wait for the mic.
Mark, how did you arrive at the figure of 1,000 members of the Communist Party in Hong Kong?
No, I said that the DAB has over 10,000 members, and this piece of information is on their website.
Sorry, I'll get back to what I'm intending to say. What would you say would be the size of the Communist Party in Hong Kong?
That is a very interesting but very difficult question. In the book, I do describe at different times when this number had been thrown up. For example, during Xu Jiatun's time, so this was in the 80s, this was, I guess, up to about 1990, because he left his office then, he said that there were about 6,000 members. I presume there are probably many more members today.
Can I just ask a question from here? In the book, you don't talk a lot about the relations between the Communist Party and the Kuomintang at the local level. You talk something about their relations on the mainland. Can you say something about that? I mean, how much did those two massive parties actually talk to each other, fight each other?
Well, I think, first of all, as many of the individuals knew each other very well, and definitely this is a part of the book where I was extremely light on, and I made a very conscious decision on this because I think this is a bit of history would probably take me another chapter to write. My publisher was pushing me very hard, and I decided I had to leave something out. I was already actually a year late in handing in my manuscript, so that's one of the things that got left out.
Okay. Bonnie Engel.
How do you do, Bonnie Engel? You said there's been this continual seduction invitations by the party from China to the important people or the VIPs of Hong Kong. Do you know if any of those people who might want to be party members could become so, or do they have to be chosen by the party to be allowed in?
I think there are two different things that you might be referring to. Many of the people who were invited to go to Beijing, this was not an invitation to become a member. In fact, the invitations for all the Hong Kong's political and economic elites to visit Beijing was really part of the PR exercise. You know, it's the United Front is the party's PR exercise. The idea was to invite them to Beijing so that they could be impressed upon that, first of all, China would allow capitalism to continue, and secondly, that you would be sitting close to or sitting with the top Chinese leaders. This is what I described as intoxicating. It was a very effective way of bringing the Hong Kong political and economic elites on side.
David O'Rear, the back.
Yeah, David O'Rear from the General. Obviously, a lot of you be dealing with the run-up to the... was a important...
Sorry.
Obviously, most of your book is going to be very... focused on the year period before the handover, just for temporal issues. But in the period since the handover, do you have a sense how important central leadership? Are we not the least troubling city in all of China, and don't they sort of have other things to think about?
The last chapter of the book, which also happens to be, I think, the most substantial chapter, is the years after 1997, and it runs from 1997 to 2009. It's much harder to write a book that is a history story, and then you come to something that is so much a part of our daily lives. And for me, as a writer, to not be too tempted to write it as a political analysis piece, but you know, see what you make of it. Hong Kong remains incredibly important to the party. And you will see this, that there's always a member of the Politburo who looks after Hong Kong affairs. The last Chinese official, party official, who led the policy on Hong Kong was Jiang Qinghong, and now we have Xi Jinping. So Hong Kong continues to be incredibly important because Hong Kong, apart from being a bit of domestic policy, is also, it has an international perspective to it as well. This is the corner in Hong Kong where having a different system, where because of having this different system, China can try out different things here, it continues to be very useful. So one of the strands of the story running throughout is how party leaders, right from the beginning, saw the convenience of Hong Kong. So perhaps what you can take away from the last chapter is decide whether you think Hong Kong continues to play an exceptionally convenient role because of the contradiction, because of the fact that we are somewhat different.
Tom and then Fergus.
Go ahead, Fergus. Fergus O'Rourke, I guess this question goes to your remark about contradiction. It's often seemed to me, at least, that the party in Hong Kong is actually more conservative than the comrades up in Beijing or elsewhere. And why do you think that may be?
I think like any institutions, the institution itself develops a certain DNA. The institution itself develops a certain vested interest. That's probably no different for the Communist Party structure in Hong Kong. Just think if they were to chuck away all the things about Hong Kong, you know, all the possibly factors that would allow subversives in Hong Kong, and who are the subversives and subversives' activities in Hong Kong, to change that, you know, to change the language that maybe none of these people are truly subversive, how might that affect their relationship with the party apparatus on the mainland? So I think these are difficult issues. They're likely to be more conservative, and I think we all know in China that right now we're at a critical time because it is the time of leadership transfer. And usually, in this kind of time, people prefer to be more rather than less conservative.
Christine, I've always been very interested in how Beijing and the party approach people in Hong Kong, sound them out, especially members of the pro-democracy camp. And so I was really interested in footnote 74 to chapter 10. I actually have read most of the book as well, where you write, the author met Liu Jianhua, who I guess was with the Chinese Academy of Sciences, through Ching Chong's introduction during his visit to Hong Kong in 2003 after the Big March, and was asked questions about what Beijing could do to dampen the desire for democratic reform. Could you tell us more about that meeting? What was your advice to him? What was your understanding of where that information was flowing back to within the party bureaucracy?
Just to remind people who Liu Jianhua is, he was the Chinese official who was sent down, one of the many Chinese officials who were sent down to Hong Kong to find out what really happened. Why did Hong Kong erupt? And why were there 500,000 people demonstrating? Liu Jianhua is still in jail today. I think many of you know or remember Ching Chong. He luckily has been released. Liu Jianhua was his partner in crime, I guess we could put it that way, and he's still in jail. This is not a secret because, again, during the time when Ching Chong was under arrest, his family, in fact, I think this was in the local news media, talked about how Ching Chong helped the system to enable Mr. Liu, when he was in Hong Kong, to meet a range of people, including myself. We had our tea. I think we talked for about 2 hours. We were in the
Marriott Hotel coffee shop. I remember it very well. We had a wonderful conversation. He asked a lot of questions about who I was and what do you do. He asked about why I thought so many people came out to demonstrate. And he said, look, I'm happy to take down whatever you say, warts and all, because that's my job. This is why I'm here. One of the things that struck me was, he says, well, how do you think we can dampen this desire for democracy? And I remember, as I said, this was a very pleasant conversation. And I said to him, I said, well, I said, that's not necessarily what we want in Hong Kong. I just wanted to recount a particular conversation without going into this much detail, but since you asked me, and none of this is a secret, the details that I met him has also been reported in the media.
Question at the back here.
Ms. Low, I'm David Tang. May I ask you what is your opinion on a certain someone whom I will not name, but might very well be our next chief executive, that he tries so hard to dispel any claim that he's a member of the Chinese Communist Party?
I don't know whether he is or is not. I presume we're talking about the same person.
This is Henry Tang.
As I said, I have no secrets to review. There are some footnotes in the book that talked about what some other people had said in public about who are party members. But as I said, I really have no idea. It's part of what I'm trying to say, which is why should the party... I mean, how long is the party going to continue to be an underground party? Once you cross the border and go to Shenzhen, it's different. It's all right for people on the mainland to say, yes, I'm a party member. And for God's sakes, there are 70 million of them right now. It's by far the largest party in the world. So I think at some stage, we do have to have a conversation about the coming out of the party. I happen to think that maybe people are still not ready for it. But I do think this situation cannot continue forever, but can obviously continue through to the next selection of the chief executive.
Francis.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Christine, first an observation and then a question. The observation is that China has a political party law. And since the passage of that law many years ago, China has never registered, the Communist Party has never registered as a party in the mainland. Now, we don't have a party registration law in Hong Kong, so there would be no requirement for it to register as a party even if it were here. Now, when Stephen Lam was information coordinator, I asked him if the Communist Party would be illegal in Hong Kong if someone attempted to form it or to register it, and he said, no group by that name has ever sought to register, therefore the question doesn't arise. So there we have with registration. On the question that I want to really want to pose is, so long as China allows the SAR to go largely its own way, to exercise the rule of law, to move orderly and gradually towards a democracy, et cetera, and fulfill the pledges of the basic law, why should it actually matter whether one is or is not a member of the Communist Party, or whether the party is or is not publicly registered in Hong Kong? And if it were to register in Hong Kong, that would be quite exceptional because it's never registered under the party law in the mainland.
Well, I think first of all is we don't necessarily have to take what is the case today to be the case tomorrow. But this issue, which pertains just to Hong Kong, is very unusual, and I think that's the only point that I'm really trying to make. And I do think this denial of the existence of the party in Hong Kong is also not sustainable, because people do know that it is here. And we do know who some of the party members are, and of course these are some of the officials that are here in Hong Kong representing different parts of the mainland Chinese system. I think it's also unusual for China and for these people who are here to kind of not to operate so differently in Hong Kong.
And I guess the question that I'm trying to ask really is this sustainable? Now, in terms of nobody has sought to register the Communist Party in Hong Kong before, yes, of course, this is correct. And this won't become an issue. This will not become an issue because the Communist Party is not about to register. The interesting thing is what happens if another party that professes to abide by communism would like to set up a party here. But nobody has tried that. Long hair is the Trotskyite. I don't think he has. He's thinking about registering such a party either. But it'll be interesting if somebody wanted to register a socialist party in Hong Kong. But it's not for me to suggest who should do what.
I can tell you, he was once asked whether he would be willing to try it, and he quietly went, "That's interesting." And it's not been pursued. But I just want to repeat the actual question that I put to you, which is, so long as Hong Kong is allowed to operate by its own rules, why does it matter?
I think Chinese officials themselves are discussing this issue. So I think it does matter. But it's not for me to say how they should decide and when they should decide.
A young craft. It is known that Communist Party organizations in the world are quite often also used to gather information. How much do you think are Communist Party members in Hong Kong being used, who perhaps work in the bank or in the revenue department, to gather information for certain purposes for Beijing?
I couldn't quite hear that question. I'm sorry, I had a little bit of problems.
Are party members using their position saying banks to gather information to give to Beijing?
That I don't know. I do not know whether there are party members and who they are who are working for commercial organizations such as banks in Hong Kong, how they gather information or what they do. And the book doesn't address this.
Do we have... I'm sorry, I got blind sight vision here. Is there anybody else who has a question here? There is here. Right in the middle, yeah.
Deirdre Lowe, just one quick question, which is, what do you think are the objectives and the activities of the Communist Party here now?
Their objectives here is to maintain harmony. In fact, all these words that you hear and read about through the media, they do mean something in party speak. They do want to have political stability, and political stability here essentially means that they control the pace and direction of elections, that power will reside in those people whom they feel comfortable with. So that's one of the key aspects, the political goals of the parties in Hong Kong. Now, of course, the party has other goals, you know, how to continue to use Hong Kong as a place of convenience for reaching out to the world and investments, loans, you know, all those things that are traditional in how they have used Hong Kong as a place of convenience.
Tom.
The first couple chapters of the book focus on the party itself, the history and rationale behind democratic centralism. I'm just curious whether or not you think that Hong Kong will ever have democracy as you would like Hong Kong to have democracy, so long as the Chinese Communist Party exists in its current form. Is it really conceivable that this organization could allow a free and fair election that anybody can be nominated to participate in?
Well, time can be very long, so I wouldn't want to constrain myself with that word. But we can see what the next step is. The next step is about making sure that there is a nominating system to ensure that people that Beijing is uncomfortable with will not hold power as the chief executive. I think we can be fairly sure that it's necessary to have such a nominating system in place before we can elect the chief executive.
Okay, question here from...
Hi, Christine. Timmy Song from RTHK. Can you be more specific on what does the Communist Party actually play what role does the Communist Party actually play in Hong Kong after the handover?
I think I just answered that question to the lady at the back. I answered that question by saying they're here to maintain political stability. You know, we're talking and social harmony, and this is on the political side and on other issues that Hong Kong continues to be a useful place for many other activities.
But maybe that question isn't answered in the sense of what do the individual members of the party actually do now?
Well, I don't know what the individual members are doing, but if we're talking about the party as an organization, for example, that there is evidence that there is an election machinery, for example, and there's evidence that there is a united front organization that mobilizes people who are not necessarily all members to come and do things that are necessary. So, for example, when there's a consultation issued by the government on democracy, on the pace of democracy. The last time we also saw this about the Article 23, the national security legislation. If you track the responses that are written to the government, you can download these from the website from LegCo, for example, some of these documents. You see the kind of organizations that write in, and if you look through them, you can see a certain similarity in their responses. So I see this as the party actively organizing a kind of community response to show support for the party preferred option. So that's a not insubstantial part of what the party is here to do.
Okay. Christine Lowe, thank you very much indeed. We traditionally present our speakers with a gift, and I know that we've all been very careful not to mention names, so what we want to give you is the collective works of C.Y. Leung.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's a light copy.
Thank you very much.
You are very naughty.
I know.
Actually, I've already got lots of these. Do you mind if I take